Sure, a lot of people have that little tickle cough that just kind of won't go away. I've had it for a couple of weeks, so pardon me if I cough a few times, or more than a few. Here's a chapter from the Bible's story of David, the second king of Israel. He was a little shepherd boy who killed the giant Goliath. Remember him? Killed the giant Goliath with a stone from his sling. Now he has armies that do his fighting for him. Armies are made of soldiers, and many soldiers had wives waiting for them at home. So we read, it happened late one afternoon when David rose from his couch and was walking on his roof that he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. David sends agents to find out who she is. They tell him that she's the wife of Uriah, a Hittite who's joined the king's mostly Hebrew army. She's probably a foreigner herself, an exotic beauty. She's known as Bathsheba, Bathsheba in Hebrew. It means the daughter of seven. A strange name that my Hebrew professor suggested might mean that she was amazing to behold. So a perfect seven in Hebrew would be like a perfect ten in current slang, or at least the slang from a 2 years back. The king becomes obsessed with her. And when you're a king, you can do more than send annoying texts. So David sent messengers and took her. And she came to him and he lay with her. Then she returned to her house and the woman conceived. And she sent and told David, I am with child. Problem. So what's a king to do? He gives Uriah a sealed letter to take to his battlefield commander when he returns to the front after his next furlough. And in the letter he wrote, set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting, then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die. Everything goes as planned, and Uriah is killed. The commander can hardly believe that this was really supposed to happen. Uriah was a great soldier and a great guy, too. He sends a messenger to tell the king and also to make excuses if need be. The messenger said to David, the men gained an advantage over us. We drove them back to the entrance of the gate. Then the archers shot at your servants from the wall. Uriah the Hittite was killed among some others. David said to the messenger, calm down. Thus you shall say to your commander, do not let this matter trouble you. For the sword devours now one, now another. Strengthen your attack on the city and overthrow it and encourage him. When the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she made lamentation for her husband. Then David brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. Bet you saw that one coming. But oddly enough, it seems to come as a shock to David. What? Me? What? We'll hear more about that after we sing. Thank you. I love that hymn. That's the two-verse instruction on how to do church and religious life. Well, how about that story I told you just before we sang the hymn? Did I mention that David had several wives and many children already before he got into this nasty business with Bathsheba and her husband? David took a soldier's wife, soldier's wife, soldier's wife. David took a soldier's wife, then he had him killed. The good King David. He's been God's little golden boy for years. But did he really think that nothing was going to happen? Now, Bible goes on. The Lord sent Nathan the prophet to David. Nathan the prophet said to the king, there were once two men in the same city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had large flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing of his own except one little ewe lamb. He reared her himself, and she grew up in his home with his own sons. She ate from his dish, drank from his cup, and nestled in his arms. She was like a daughter to him. One day, A traveler came to the rich man's house, and he, too mean to take something from his own flocks and herds to give to his guests, stole the poor man's lamb and served her up for dinner. Just imagine that. Imagine this is the lamb, and you know, this is how my baby girl. You know, the way I talk to my kitten. How does this story make you feel? How about the king? David was very angry and burst out, "As the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. He shall pay for the lamb four times over because he's done this and shown no pity." Then Nathan said to David, "You are the man. This is the word of the Lord. I anointed you king over Israel. I gave you everything you needed. I gave you the daughters of Israel and Judah. And had this not been enough, I would have added favors as great. But you've murdered Uriah, and you've stolen his wife. You have done wrong in the eyes of the Lord." What a windup. What a pitch. Or maybe we should be thinking slings and stones instead of baseball to keep with the times. It's David's turn to be Goliath now as he takes it right between the eyes. Pow! You said it yourself. Whoever would do such a thing deserves to die. So he'd better understand how lucky he is that he's only paying four times over for the lamb. He can't give her life back, but he should know that that's what he really owes to the poor man and to the balance of the universe itself, or as Nathan puts it, God. You don't, you don't have to believe in any God to understand the power of this story. You don't have to be the practicing member of any of the traditions that hold David near and dear to the heart of their faith experience, Judaism, Christianity, or Islam. It belongs to all humanity. It could be retold with appropriate local names and titles anywhere in the world, from the Arctic to the equator and on to Antarctica. And it would yield its meaning time and again. And that meaning would never be exhausted. Such a story has got what it takes to keep going from generation to generation. And stories like that, that's the real stuff of religion. The meat and the bones. When I was studying for the ministry, I was lucky enough to secure a place in one of the most coveted classes on all of Holy Hill. This is this place, Hill in Berkeley, that was shared by 12 different seminaries. There were Catholic and Protestant and other religious institutes. Cross-enrollment was encouraged, but this class was one of the hardest to get into, called Meaning in Dreams and Dreaming. It was taught by Jeremy Taylor, a world-renowned dream worker and also a UU minister. Jeremy was the first minister ordained at the Little Berkeley Fellowship of Unitarian Universalists. I was the second. Jeremy asked me to be his teaching assistant for the next term. Later, when Pam and I got engaged, we asked him to do our wedding. But nowadays, Jeremy's books are published by big outfits like Paulus Press or Penguin. But basic hints for dream work then was Xeroxed from typewritten sheets and stapled at home. Those basic hints include some profound observations like these. Every dream has an element of self-criticism. Every dream has an element of creative inspiration and problem-solving. Every dream has an element of religious concern and intuition about the inevitability of death. Religious beliefs from around the world can be seen reflected in common dream experiences. Well, near the top of the list comes an observation that for many students was the most surprising and transformative one of all. Every dream depicts elements of the dreamer's personality and vital energies in its imagery. The people and things and situations in your dreams all represent aspects of yourself, but they also often represent waking life people, situations, and things at the same time. Jeremy would often summarize this insight as, "You are everyone and everything in your dream." But he also stressed how the dream has dimensions that go beyond you and your personal experience. It should be no surprise that students from a wide range of religious traditions would take elements of Jeremy's insights and techniques and apply them to the many dreams, visionary experiences, and even waking life stories preserved by those traditions. That's the real lamb shanks, the real meat and bones of religion, right? Of course, a tradition imposes some edits in that raw meat and bones that dreams don't. But what do we find if we look at today's story through the lens of dream work? After a student shared a dream in a class, Jeremy would caution us, never jump in and say, "I know just what that means." Rather, we should approach it by both saying and thinking, "If this were my dream, if this were my dream, would it mean, could it be?" So what if the story of rich man, poor man, ewe lamb, city, prophet, king, was a dream you had last night? If it was your dream, what are some things that it might mean for you? What if you were everyone and everything in this great, sad, ancient story? Perhaps you'd like to close your eyes for a moment. Can you see yourself as the poor man? As the poor man. Have you ever felt that something precious, something that should really have no value for anyone else, has been taken from you for no good reason? What was it? What did you cherish and pamper and nurture from your own plate that suddenly disappeared? Mary had a little lamb like the poor man in the city. What did you have that was taken without pity? Can you see it? Do you feel that hole inside of you still? If every dream has an element of creative inspiration and problem solving, are you getting some idea of what to do with this empty space? Jeremy Taylor also tells us that every dream has an element of self-criticism. That brings us to what might be an even more painful question. Can you see yourself as the rich man in the story? I'm not necessarily talking about big houses or big bank accounts. As the Reverend Dr. Thandeka, she was a keynote speaker at our recent district assembly, as she wrote in 1999, 49.9% of us are college graduates, she means UUs, and our median annual household income is $34,800, 1999. In other words, members of our association tend to have a big brain and a small purse. I'm not only talking about individual responsibility when I ask if we can see the rich man in ourselves, but also a deeper kind of awareness. It's the kind of awareness that we affirm in our seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence, the web of all existence of which we are a part. Do we see how many of the good things we enjoy, and often in surplus, are connected to the exploitation of third world workers, to a history of slavery, to stealing land from native populations and eliminating those populations, to mining the resources of that land to the point of undermining it? I'm not talking about wallowing in guilt for these things, just maintaining awareness. Those who ignore or deny them, I think, are experiencing life as like a radio that's not quite tuned in. Or maybe, speaking personally, maybe there really is someone from whom you've personally taken something precious. I don't want to overlook that possibility. I know most of you are such sweet people. But our actions really can rob another person of their self-esteem, their confidence, or the little lamb that we call childhood. Sometimes Mary never had a little lamb, little lamb, little lamb, never had a little lamb, and she thinks that it's her fault. When you know who's really behind it. One of the real strengths of 12-step programs like Alcoholics Anonymous is the requirement that we make an inventory of persons we have harmed and then do what we can to make amends. Talk about a dream, the AA dream, that has strong elements of self-criticism. Any dream of recovery had better have plenty of those. Here's another tough question. Can you see yourself as the king, the shepherd king, right? Listening to that story within a story, like a dream within a dream. What does the story say about being king? You are the ruler. Remember the ruler that you carried to school when you were a kid? Maybe it had three holes in it so you could click it into your three-ring binder. The spacing for those holes was standardized, like the spacing of the lines on your paper. A ruler on a throne or a ruler in your binder should help to maintain certain standards. So an inch is an inch, not a mile. But rulers worldwide have always enjoyed a certain flexibility themselves when it comes to the rules they lay on others. Some of you might have read that the Sultan of Brunei is imposing a Sharia law on his people. I'd like to investigate his bank accounts and see how compliant with Islamic finance law they are. Just asking. But that's a benefit of authority. Stay in any one place long enough and you're likely to acquire a certain measure of authority and a measure of flexibility when it comes to you yourself following the rules. You're the man, as we say, whatever your gender. You might have seen the movie School of Rock, starring Jack Black as a would-be rock star who masquerades as a substitute teacher at a fancy private school. Okay. He starts a rock band with the students in his class, and then he explains to them how the man spoils everything of value. When the kids tell their principal, who's played by Joan Cusack, that she's the man, she cluelessly answers, "Well, thank you." She's great. That's also what the prophet Nathan yells at his ruler when David says, "The rich man deserves to die for taking the poor man's little lamb, or at least pay four times over. Ata ha'ish, you are the man on whom you've just imposed this ruling. You forgot your humanity, king." If this was your dream, you would also be the prophet. What's a prophet? Isn't he or she the voice of our deepest values? The prophet's task is to point out what those are in case they've been forgotten, and to speak truth to power, to say you've crossed the line. Even when speaking to the king or whatever the man is called in our present situation. Jeremy Taylor says that every dream has an element of religious concern and intuition about the inevitability of death. Our highest, deepest principles are intended to be life-giving, or else why would they matter? Violate them, treat them lightly, and the shadow of death will not be far away. The prophet inside of you senses this approach. If you are rich man, poor man, prophet, and king, if you are everyone and everything in this dream, what else must you be? What else must you be? How about the ewe lamb that had nestled in the poor man's arms? Are you someone's treasured creature? Treasured creature, beloved and cherished beyond all else. So that if you should be taken away from them, you would leave a hole in their heart that's bigger than their heart. Are you now, or have you ever been? The little ewe lamb, who is it? Is that you, without you even knowing? I recently saw the masterpiece film, 12 Years a Slave, based on the memoirs of Solomon Northrup, a free black New Yorker, a carpenter and musician who was kidnapped and sold into slavery in the Deep South. Torn for a dozen years away from his own family, he witnessed other black families torn apart forever, sold as individual parcels of property. How many parents experienced this? How many children who might not even have remembered later that it happened? What has such a legacy cost us, all of us, as a single people? And how long will it take to repay? That's the message in the prophet Nathan's story. We may be everyone and everything in our dreams, but there are few things as such in this story. In this story that so many of us have shared for so many centuries. Today, we don't think of lambs as things, let alone people. So what's left? There's a cup and a plate. And both could represent resources that we have to offer those for whom we care. Service. What else is there? How about the city? The city itself. We're not told the name of that city where the rich man and the poor man live, but we know the king lives in Jerusalem, the city of peace. In Arabic, it's called Al-Quds, which means the holy. And that's what it is for three great faith traditions. A holy city. A sacred place. A place where our faith is somehow concentrated. Where our values are collected and held as high as our hopes and dreams. Ah, the punishment will rain down upon you, Miguel.
No less than
that. Are you that city and everyone in it? Rich, poor, ruler, prophet, and ewe lamb, ravishing beauty, humble soldier, and even the rooftop from which you can see them all within your walls and on beyond them. I hope that all of yous, can see yourself as being at least this rich, so full and complex that you'd never need to steal, as all of us are, right here, right now. May there be peace in this city. May there be justice. And maybe when we see everyone and everything within and around us as holy, peace and justice, we will have them both. Peace and justice and joy and service, we will have them all. If only we keep dreaming. So may it be.